From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Many of us think of the study of astronomy as simply charting the planets, the stars, and the galaxies. Today we look at the search not just for what, but for who's out there, as well as where we ourselves might go to live should we elect to leave planet Earth. Frank Drake is a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is also the president of the SETI Institute. That's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I'll talk to Dr. Drake about how we are approaching this search. I'll also speak with Carl Sagan. Dr. Sagan is popularly known for the PBS series Cosmos. He is currently the director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies at Cornell University. We'll talk to him about one of his latest interests, looking for habitable planets. Frank Drake is president of the SETI Institute. In the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, we're not just looking for life, we're looking for intelligence. I asked him to define that.
Most scientists would define intelligence as the ability to communicate very complicated concepts from one creature to another. But in our case, we're searching for radio signals, and so our working definition of intelligence is an intelligent creature is anything that knows how to build a radio transmitter.
Why are we looking for intelligence?
Why are we looking for intelligence? In a nutshell, everything we've learned about the origin of stars like our sun, the origin of the solar system, the development of life on this planet and its evolution, says that all of those processes were completely normal processes in the history of a star in our galaxy. And this means that what happened here should have happened in many places. No special circumstances or freak conditions were required. So what happened here should have happened many, many times, and that means there must be many, many systems of intelligent creatures out there to be found. That doesn't mean they're easy to find, because the cosmos is a vast and awesome place, and we may have to search for many years before we succeed.
Okay, so let's go back to this original concept that they would have to be able to build a radio transmitter. Does that imply a certain frequency and amplitude of signal?
It implies that they are knowledgeable of the basic facts of science and of astronomy. And you may wonder, why astronomy? And the answer is that once we have learned about our universe, we've come to realize that there are certain frequencies, like the frequency on which this broadcast is carried, which are most easily detected across the great distances which separate the stars. And this isn't a result of the state of your technology or how smart you are. It's a consequence of the structure of the universe itself. At the lowest frequencies, what we would call radio frequencies on Earth, our galaxy emits a cacophony of noise which drowns out signals. If we go to the various highest frequencies, which are those of light waves and infrared waves, the quantum nature of radiation makes those frequencies noisy also. But in between, at the frequencies we on Earth call microwaves, there is a band of frequencies where the universe is very dark and very quiet. And therefore, you can hear signals, weak signals, at enormous distances. Or, if you're trying to communicate, you will use these frequencies because you can do it successfully with the least effort and the least expense.
Now, you're the president of the SETI Institute. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Tell us about the Institute.
Well, the Institute is it's a nonprofit research institute, which we founded now 8 years ago, seems like yesterday, to work in collaboration with NASA to produce by far the most powerful search for extraterrestrial radio signals ever mounted. And the idea was to exploit the modern computer technology, which made it possible to build systems which monitored typically tens of millions of radio frequencies at once. This created a capability far beyond anything we'd had before, and a capability which gives us a real chance of finding signals. To do it well, we needed this nonprofit institute, and so we brought it into being. It's a way of doing this work for NASA in a very inexpensive way, And at the present time, the Institute has about 20 projects related to various aspects of life in the universe, ranging from the origins of life to the nature of planetary atmospheres to means to detect other planetary systems. But, of course, its main activity is the radio search for extraterrestrial signals. And because Congress ended funding for the project a few months ago, the Institute is now operating the project itself as a private research enterprise. And I'm pleased to say we've gotten massive private financial backing for the project. And so it is going to go on, even though the federal government is no longer supporting it.
Well, let's have a little history on the funding for the SETI project and who is involved now in the new private funding.
The SETI project, or properly, the SETI program actually started 33 years ago when I made the first modern radio search for radio signals. And that has been followed on over the last 33 years with a multitude of searches, now some 60 different radio searches for signals, but all of them modest, most of them with inadequate funding to do what people could have done and wanted to do. But this has led to increasingly more powerful searches. And even 20 years ago, at the NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, a group started to work on creating a NASA project to search for signals. Over the years, that grew until finally it became an approved NASA mission with an annual cost of about $10 million. That mission was about 4 years old as of a year ago and had expended $58 million to build enormously capable radio receiving systems, which were then deployed at the various large radio telescopes, such as the one at Arecibo, Puerto Rico, to search the 1,000 nearest sun-like stars for signs of life and also to search the entire sky. A total of about 80 people were working in this project up until the time it was terminated, at least with regard to federal funding. The number of people has now shrunk. The program itself has shrunk somewhat. But the main activities, and particularly the search of the 1,000 nearest stars, is going on as planned.
Why did funding get cut?
The funding was cut by Congress because it was in a deficit reduction mode, and it was looking for anything to cut, and unfortunately SETI became a target. And it was not a result of any technical criticisms or scientific criticism, simply a cost-cutting measure.
Did you find anything in 33 years?
In 33 years, as I said, there have been many projects. And from those projects, there have been three which found what you would call good candidate signals. Now, these are signals which have what we call a signature of an extraterrestrial signal. And this is a very important aspect of these signals, and that is that they behave in a way which is an interfering signal from one of our own transmitters would not behave. They are very distinct in having characteristics different from the signals we create. One of these was found years ago at the Ohio State University. It's known, it's a famous signal. It's known as the WOW signal, because everybody said WOW when they saw it. There was a very good candidate found in Australia a few years ago. And at Harvard University, where there's been a long-term, very powerful project, there have been roughly 15 good candidate signals found. Now, of course, you're going to say, why don't you know what these are? And the reason is that all of these signals have been detectable only for a short time. And in the SETI business, we want to be absolutely sure that we have a real detection before we reach that conclusion and release what may be the biggest news of the century. So in each case, the observers have gone back and looked at the same star and the same frequencies for hours or days, but never has the signal returned. And as a result, one is left with an inconclusive result. Tantalizing, yes, but conclusive, no. And so we have candidate signals, but no certain detections yet.
Who's providing the private funding now for the SETI project?
We've been provided with some very generous gifts from a number of people. So far, all of them are people who have been very successful leaders in the high-tech industry. And they not only understand the technology of our project, but they have a sense of science and the fact that this is a project which is really promising. Among the donors are David Packard, co-founder of the Hewlett-Packard Company, former Secretary of Defense, William Hewlett, the other co-founder of the Hewlett-Packard Company, Gordon Moore, who is a co-founder of the Intel Corporation, which is the prime producer of computer chips in the United States and in the world, for that matter, Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, the most successful software company, Barney Oliver, former vice president for research of Hewlett-Packard Corporation.
These are individuals you're talking about.
These are individuals, yes.
And these are very successful, conservative individuals, and they believe so heavily in this project, not a government, not a foundation, not an educational institution. They're actually providing personal funding to support it.
That's right. And it's, I think, a great tribute to them and if you will pardon me, the American way of life.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Frank Drake. He's a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. What is a good candidate signal? Are we just getting stray signals coming in through this mid-band? You know, what is a good candidate?
Well, let me tell you what happens when you're actually observing. When you're actually observing, you're monitoring maybe 15 million possible frequency channels at once, which is an incredible feat and a great credit to our electronics designers and our computer industry. And when you do that, in many channels, you receive signals. And these are our signals, signals which leak into the telescope or perhaps reflected from airplanes or from spacecraft or even the moon. And these are, of course, intelligent signals. And and the very important question is, how do you distinguish these from the true, occasional, true extraterrestrial signal? Well, first, an intelligent signal has three basic characteristics. It occupies a very narrow range of frequencies, or bandwidth, as we say. Secondly, it's highly polarized. It means the waves all beat in the same direction. Natural signals don't do that. And thirdly, we would expect it, although it's not necessary, that there be information coded on the signal. That is, the signal will change as time goes on. Now, all of our signals have those three characteristics, as will the extraterrestrial signals. The one thing the extraterrestrial signals have, which our signals from Earth don't have, is a special Doppler effect. A change in frequency due to a change in speed between the transmitter and the receiver. And you might say, well, gee, that sounds confusing. But the fact is that our telescopes are moving on a rotating planet that's going in an orbit around the sun at a speed of 20 miles a second or so. And this introduces a very strong Doppler effect on the extraterrestrial signals, but not on the signals from Earth. And the effect, the Doppler effect, or shift in frequency introduced to the signals, is very specific, and we can easily measure it. And so this becomes a very powerful, in fact, clear-cut test, which allows us to determine which signals are from Earth and which are truly of extraterrestrial origin.
Now, you were saying earlier about interfering signals, so I'm going to go out here on a little limb. And given what you've just said, it says, gee, if you're trying to really fake out the scientists standing around looking at the telescope, and you're sending signals from nearby, because you're within the Earth's atmosphere, you won't be able to generate this Doppler effect, mainly because you're not moving through space as the signal's coming in. Could you do the same thing if you put a satellite up? I mean, why would you do this?
Yes, you could do this from a satellite, because if we had our telescope in a satellite, we would be able to calculate what the Doppler effect created by the motion of the satellite is and compensate for that. In fact, that's routinely done with spacecraft today. So although it sounds challenging, it's something we know how to do very well.
Now, another thing you talked about is that you presume that the signal would change. And why wouldn't the signal just say, we're here, we're here, we're here, call us, we're here, we're here? I mean, that's a repeatable signal.
Well, it may do that. And in fact, That's one of the fun things that to think about. If you're sitting around on a cold winter's evening by a fire, it's nice to think about what would the extraterrestrial signal be like. Well, maybe they will be trying to contact us, in which case the signal will be a very distinct one, probably with a very simple message like, yes, here we are. We are here, and if you tune to such and such a frequency, you will receive our encyclopedia.
Free.
Free. And that's every SETI observer's fantasy that would come upon that. But, of course, that may not happen. And in fact, sadly, it's probably unlikely. So when we search, we not only search for that kind of signal, which we call a beacon signal, by the way. It has a name. But we also make our systems and design them so that they can detect signals that the civilization might be using for its own purposes. It's television, it's telemetry, it's et cetera, et cetera.
And actually just might be pointed our way.
Just happen to be pointed our way, yes.
Now, are we sending signals out from the Earth?
We do not send signals. We did once in the year 1974. We did send a message, which is in a way a clue as to what we might receive. That message was sent at the rate of 10 characters a second, which is quite slow, but that was done on purpose to make the message very detectable. And that message took only 3 minutes to send. But by the time the last characters were being sent, the first characters were already passing the orbit of Mars. And in 8 hours, it left the solar system, and now it's four times the distance to the nearest star. That shows us how it's good to use radio. It gets places fast. And that message could be decoded easily to produce a very simple picture, which showed a lot of things about the Earth. That's the only message we've sent. And the reason we don't send other messages is that we're doing it for free. The strongest sign of our existence are the television signals sent from Earth. And there are literally tens of thousands of those. They are very powerful. The Earth twinkles with radio signals, television signals, as it rotates in a very distinctive way, and I suspect even beautiful way, to other civilizations looking at us. And from those signals, they can learn not only of our existence, but everything they want to know about us, both the good and the bad.
Now let's just place ourselves out there, and we finally have gotten to the point where we can receive these signals. We're out there, and we're very intelligent, and we see all this stuff coming from the Earth. I mean, we'd have to kind of guess how to put those signals together to read them.
We can guess, but it's not a hard guess. If you've received the signals and you've looked at the waveforms, even briefly, I would think 10 minutes would be enough, you would recognize how to deal with those signals so as to construct the pictures that are present in them and decode the audio signals and all the rest.
So it's sort of like a mystery. You know, we have this data, and we say, well, gee, let's put it together this way and that way, and eventually you're going to make some sense out of it.
Yes, and we've never really worried much about that because you know full well that if you ever got such a signal, all the greatest minds on the planet would go to work to decipher it. And that would be enough brain power to decode almost anything, I think.
Well, I'm just afraid they're going to get Leave It to Beavers.
Well, you know, that's unfortunately, the signals now reaching the most stars are those of Howdy Doody, and they've just gotten the first Super Bowl in about 1,000 stars, and they're just dying to see what's going to happen in the second Super Bowl.
That's great. Actually, that is interesting. You know, I think we often think of that we do a performance or we have a radio show, and it's over. But it's living on.
That's right. These signals never disappear completely. They get weaker and weaker. But if you have a big enough radio telescope, you can still collect them, even tens of thousands of years later.
Well, what happens if you get a signal and it looks, everyone says, wow. I mean, the second time, the big wow. We all agree. There's somebody out there. Has there been a plan or an agreement or a policy as to what's going to happen?
Yes, indeed, there is a policy. In fact, it's called a protocol, which has been adopted by all the major projects and all the major international scientific organizations that have some dealings with this area of research. And this protocol is 8 pages long, but what it says primarily is, first, be really sure you've really detected an extraterrestrial signal. And secondly, you will announce it to the world immediately. There will be no secrecy, no cover-up of anything. And thirdly, you won't answer right away. You will learn about this civilization and only answer after there's a broad consensus as to what a reasonable reply, if any, should be.
Well, who will answer? Who's in charge of answering?
Nobody's in charge of answering, and that's not spelled out. And in fact, we don't have a mechanism in the world to govern that. In many countries, anybody can set up a radio transmitter and transmit. In the United States, you have to be licensed by the FCC, but in principle, this station can send a transmission to the stars. There's nothing to stop them.
It's interesting to me that you say we'll make an immediate announcement. I mean, nothing has been, I'd say, truly a third of everything that ever went on in the world got changed because it was cloaked in secrecy or there was a delay or some part of it was known. Why are they saying immediate announcement?
There are a number of reasons. The main one is that we think, those of us in the field, think this is really an important discovery and the world should know all about it right away because it's going to, in the long run, have an enormous impact on human life. In the short run, of course, it'll be a very exciting bit of news. And so we feel, yes, the people of the world should know about this right away. And secondly, it's to allay the fears of some people that there will be a cover-up or that the information will not be released because there have been tales of that nature in the past in other areas, and we just don't want the world to think that anything like that's going to happen with SETI.
My guest today is Dr. Frank Drake. He is the president of the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. You said that the SETI Institute had some 20 other projects. Tell us about some of those projects.
Well, the SETI Institute's charter authorizes it to support any research associated with the nature of life in the universe. And once you think about that, that covers a broad range of subjects. Where did the chemical elements come from? What is the nature of life on Earth? Are there alternative chemistries which could give you living things? How does evolution work? What planets are possibly inhabitable or have viable surfaces and atmospheres? Why did we not find life on Mars? What is the Martian surface like? So there's a tremendous range of subjects, and we deal in a lot of them. One of our areas of research is developing methods to detect other planetary systems, not life, but just other planetary systems, because it's very important to us to know how many planetary systems there are. The more there are, the better the chances are that there's a lot of life out there. We have groups studying the chemistry of the Martian surface to see why it's so different from the Earth's surface, and in a way very inhospitable to life. We have a project in which people are studying the way energy is handled in archaebacteria. Now, archaebacteria are the oldest living creatures on Earth. They were the first living creatures, and surprisingly, some of them still exist. And their chemistry, the way they ate things, the way they metabolized, was very different from modern animals and bacteria. And we want to understand that because that tells us something about places where life could exist. We have projects to examine the chemical pathways which might have led to the molecules which are basic to life on Earth. And we have projects which are simply developing instruments for spacecraft which may be used in future spacecraft to look for biological molecules on the planets of the solar system. So that's a taste. That's not everything, but it's a taste of what we do.
I know you got your funding cut, and you've got tremendous support now in the private sector. But let's say this captures the imagination of the American people, and they say, okay, Frank, you know, tell us how much you need. What projects would you do now that you can't do?
Well, oh, boy. Yeah, It's sort of like asking somebody for their Christmas list or something.
It's not Christmas, but it's all yours. Of course, I can't do anything about it.
Yeah, but maybe some of the listeners can. We welcome any help. We could do a lot more in the way of radio searching. The equipment we have, as I said, can monitor 15 million channels at once. And we've been building that equipment for 4 years. And in 4 years, there are tremendous advances in computers. In fact, the capability of SETI systems has been doubling every 250 days for the last 33 years. And if you work that out, the systems we have today are 100 trillion times more powerful than the one I used in 1960. So you may wonder why I bothered, but you've got to start somewhere. Anyway, we could, if we started today, build systems that would monitor, say, 200 million channels. And it would take several millions of dollars to build those, but that's all, and that's quite remarkable. And we should do that. Another thing we very badly need is our own radio telescope. At the present time, we have fabulous receiving systems. They're all packaged in transportable trailers, and we take them to existing radio telescopes, which we use as guest observers. And that is very fine, but you don't get a great deal of observing time. And more than that, you don't have the opportunity to optimize the equipment, to twiddle it, to tinker with it, the way you do if you have your own radio telescope and you can leave the equipment attached all the time. So we would like to build our own radio telescope for SETI. In fact, we have a design for it and a site for it. Total cost is about $10 million. Those are the two things that I would do if some ready cash became available.
You must believe at some level that there's some extraterrestrial intelligence out there. What do you believe? And what are people's reactions to you about that?
I'm very convinced there's intelligent life out there. It's not hard to reach that conclusion. There are, in our galaxy, about 100 billion stars like the Sun, with probably similar histories. And then there are 200 billion other galaxies, each with their own 100 billion suns. So there must be a great deal of intelligent life out there, many of it much older than ours, presumably more advanced. So I'm quite convinced of that. If you ask me a second question, which is it easy to find, then I'm much more in the dark and uncertain, because I think it's hard to find, but if we work hard enough, we will, and that we're doing the right things now. What reaction do I get from people? As I said, when people become knowledgeable about this area, they become very enthusiastic about it. And so almost all the time, not always, but almost inevitably, people are very enthusiastic about this project and the prospects for life in the universe.
But sometimes they're not.
There are a few that somehow think that there must be something we don't understand about evolution, or that there was something special which gave rise to life on Earth that we haven't recognized, and so they're concerned that maybe life is in fact rare. But there is no evidence whatsoever to support those ideas.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure.
My guest today has been Frank Drake. He is a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's the president of the SETI Institute. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Carl Sagan is the director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies at Cornell University. I was able to speak with him at NASA while he was attending the first international conference on circumstellar habitable zones. I asked him just exactly what that meant.
Well, here's this lovely planet, the Earth, that we live on, and things are just right for us. Despite the fluctuations in weather, the temperatures are perfect for the kind of life that we are and know about. We have liquid water. Everything's terrific. Go just a little bit closer to the sun, and it's terribly hot, and there's no liquid water. It's all boiled away. And go just a little further from the sun, and it's terribly cold, and the water is all frozen. And so there is a habitable zone, it is proposed, in our solar system. Not too hot, not too cold, but just right, like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears story. And while we could argue that this is too parochial, too earth chauvinist, that different kinds of life might like different kinds of conditions, or that there is liquid water far out in the solar system, kept liquid, not just by sunlight. We can argue all of that. But within this somewhat narrow perspective, the question is, are there habitable zones around other stars? And are there planets in those habitable zones? And that's, of course, connected to the question of, could there be life? Could there be abundant life? Could the Milky Way galaxy be rippling with life? That's what this meeting is about. And the exciting part is that the relevant sciences have now reached a degree of maturity where we can actually say something semi-well-based on this issue. And if I had to summarize what is coming out of this meeting, it's that there's a lot of habitable zones. That it seems likely that most, maybe all, stars like the Sun have at least one planet in their habitable zones. And even even stars quite different from the Sun may have planets in their habitable zones. This doesn't prove that there's life there. It doesn't prove that there's intelligence there. But it's a step.
So we're talking about human habitable zones.
No, not at all. I mean, the bugs that inhabit your gut also are interested in liquid water. All of us on Earth, we're all the same. The superficial differences between bacteria and earthworms and humans and blue whales aside, we are all biochemically the same. And so we all live in roughly the same temperature range and require liquid water. We're all made of the same stuff, the same amino acids and nucleic acids and so on. We're all the same.
Well, forgive me for saying it just this way, but why does it all boil down to liquid water?
Well, as I say, it may be a chauvinism, but there are reasons. Liquid water is a marvelous medium for chemical interaction. Things dissolve in it. Things react in it. It is a medium to transport one kind of molecule so it meets another kind of molecule. All liquids will do that. It has a very wide range of stability. The boiling point and the freezing point are far from each other. It takes an awful lot of energy to vaporize or boil away water, which is another element of stability. And there are other things having to do with dielectric constants and so on. If you looked at all the possible materials in the universe and had to choose an interaction medium for life, you very well might choose liquid water. And there's one other thing. Water is cosmically very abundant. You know, suppose it were lithium hexafluoride, which was the optimum material. We'd say, well, that's nice, but there isn't much lithium hexafluoride around. But it isn't. It looks like water, which is very abundant, is the optimum such material. Now, maybe there are other materials as well. Maybe liquid hydrocarbons, which might exist on Titan, the big moon of Saturn. Maybe liquid ammonia somewhere. If we've been too narrow, if we've been too parochial in focusing on liquid water, then it just means that the opportunities for life are even wider than we're saying.
You were referring to earlier the idea that the water is liquid because of its proximity to the sun. Why don't you tell us about the early faint sun problem?
Well, there's this problem. Some people call it a paradox. The sun, which seems to us so stable, shining brightly every day, is in fact slowly getting brighter. by slowly, I mean over a period of billions of years. Put another way, at the time of the origin of life, 4 billion years ago, it was about 30% dimmer. And this is an inexorable consequence of the physics of stars. This is not a, you know, unique or idiosyncratic aspect of the sun. All main sequence stars slowly increase in brightness. But if this is the case, then 4 billion years ago, and even 2 billion years ago, the Earth ought to have been frozen solid. And yet we have excellent geological evidence that there was abundant liquid water 2, 3, and 4 billion years ago, and it was needed for the origin of life, we believe. So what's wrong? What is the resolution of this? At this meeting, there are two different views being expressed. One is that the early sun was a little more massive and has lost its mass since then, and a more massive sun means a brighter sun, and that'll do it. Another view, the one that Chris Chaiba and I have been advocating, is that there was a small amount of powerful greenhouse gases in the early atmosphere of the Earth that are no longer here, of which ammonia is an example. One part in 100,000 of ammonia in the Earth's atmosphere is enough to make a very major increment in the greenhouse effect and explain the problem. I would say it's not clear which of these two is the explanation, but probably something like this, or maybe a mix of the two, is the answer.
So you can still sort of cling to proximity to the sun as long as certain other conditions might...
That's right, and this early faint sun paradox suggests that things are not as simple as just how far you are from the star. Stars change, and what stuff you have in your atmosphere can affect what the conditions are. The Earth, for example, is about 35 degrees centigrade warmer than it would be without an atmosphere because of the greenhouse effect. And Venus is some 600 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it would be because of its massive greenhouse effect. So if you forget about greenhouse effects, you're not going to figure this out right.
How are we going to find out where these planets are that have liquid water?
Well, we have now found one other star which has planets, and this seems very clear. It's, of all things, a pulsar, the very dense, very rapidly rotating, high magnetic field remnant of a supernova explosion. Nobody would have expected that to be the first place we'd find other planets, but from what are called the timing residuals in the signals from, I don't mean intelligent signals, from this star, it now is very clear that there are planets, Earth mass planets, at Earth-like distances from the star. And I think that greatly enhances the odds that planets are a dime a dozen.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Carl Sagan, Director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies and Professor of Astronomy at Cornell University. How important is it for Americans to understand science?
I believe it's absolutely essential, because there's hardly an aspect of our society which doesn't involve, not casually, but fundamentally, science and technology. And in a democracy, if we don't understand the most basic tools that run the society, then we've lost control of our own future. Someone else is going to make these decisions. And who are those guys? Some bunch of technocrats, or some bunch who don't even understand the science and technology? We've done something extremely stupid. We've made a society based on science and technology and arranged it so that almost nobody understands science and technology. That is as clear a prescription for disaster as you could imagine. We might get away with it for a little bit, but sooner or later, this mix of ignorance and power is going to do us in. It is essential for our survival to use these powerful tools in the most humane and wise way. And the only way to guarantee that is not to shuffle the responsibility off to somebody else, but to make sure that every citizen understands science and technology to some extent. in the same way that our hunter-gatherer ancestors, all of them understood, you know, how to string a bow or how to make a digging tool, the things that their lives depended on. Everybody knew how to do it. We have to do better at teaching science and technology and making people excited about it. I think every child is a natural-born scientist, and we beat their interest out of them by the time they get to high school. And we could arrange a society very different from that.
How would you restructure it?
I think the problems in science and technology education run through the society. It's not just one thing that has to be fixed. It has to do with inadequately trained teachers. It has to do with kids who don't want to work. It has to do with parents who don't encourage their kids to learn. It has to do with school bond issues, which are not passed because people don't want to spend money on education. It has to do with newspapers, most of which in America have a daily astrology column, but not even a weekly science column. It has to do with the federal government. When's the last time you heard an intelligent discussion of science by a president of the United States? And so on. It just runs right through the society. When's the last time you saw a discussion of science? I don't mean technology. I don't mean medicine. Science on 60 Minutes or Face the Nation or the News of the Week in Review or the Brinkley Show or all the rest of them. When is the last time you saw a television dramatic program in which the hero or heroine is somebody who is simply devoted to finding out how the universe works? How do we provide role models to people to get excited about science if none of the media and none of the politicians and almost nobody else themselves evince an excitement and enthusiasm about science?
Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of things about science. One is that it doesn't always conform to our predispositions. We can't foist our wishes on the universe. Universe has its own agenda. And so we have to adjust our thinking to a universe which, in many respects, doesn't know about human beings. Also, sometimes things are complicated. In part, it may be because of human fallibility and limitations, in part because the universe is intrinsically complicated. And so it takes a little work. Another thing is that science does not respect authority. Doesn't matter what politicians or religious leaders or anybody else says is true. It sometimes turns out that the universe is a different way, and that upsets people in power. There are a number of other reasons, but that gives a little bit of a flavor of there's one more important reason, and that is that science has delivered instruments of destruction that make people, understandably, for very good reasons, nervous. And you can see this in the mad scientist images on Saturday morning children's programs. You can see it in all the Faustian bargains in popular culture, from Dr. Frankenstein to Dr. Strangelove to Jurassic Park. We are nervous about the tremendous powers that science gives us, and for very good reason. I mean, we are right to be nervous about thermonuclear weapons. We are right to be nervous about the destruction of the ozonosphere and the increasing greenhouse effect. And science has provided these tools willy-nilly, which can be used for good and for ill. And, scientists, like everybody else, are part of their own culture and will do things when asked by those in authority. And it happens, but it doesn't happen often enough that scientists say, no, this is wrong. Scientists were greeted with open arms by the political leaders of many nations in the around 1940, when they said, look, a weapon of the most extraordinary power can be made, and we, whichever nation we are, have to get it before those other guys, because we are responsible and they're not. Scientists were loved when that happened. But when, in the period, say, 45 to 60, in many cases, those same scientists went to the political leaders and said, now, wait a minute, you don't want to build a lot of these things. You don't want to drop it on defenseless civilians. There are consequences to this. The scientists were told to go mind their own business. This wasn't their issue. They were to develop the weapons, but not to worry about the responsible use. What I'm trying to say here is that scientists have, in some cases, played a heroic role. Leo Szilard and Andrei Sakharov, for example, in trying to prevent the misuse of nuclear weapons. But it is also true that scientists provided the nuclear weapons. Fortunately, we have come out of the Cold War without a really grave nuclear catastrophe, and I hope that will continue to be the case. But it could have happened. And if science doesn't show its humane face, if people don't understand what science is about, then, of course, there's going to be continuing sense of nervousness about science and scientists.
Well, that brings me to another question, and that's about nervousness and fear and what you may find, and the scientist doesn't know what he or she may find. And that's when we're talking about looking for life, intelligent life, beyond Earth. And there's a lot of fear about that.
Yeah, I think largely misplaced, because after all, what the radio search for extraterrestrial intelligence is doing is listening. We're not sending, we're listening, or we're hoping to listen. And that means if we get a signal, which clearly is of intelligent origin, nobody out there knows we've got the signal. The broadcasting civilization has no way to know that we have received their message unless we choose to respond. We may choose not to respond. And that's a decision that ought to be made, again, not by just a few scientists, ought to be made by the human community. So if we're worried about giving away our position, about informing extraterrestrials that, we're here and they might come and, I don't know, eat us, which I think bizarrely implausible, but if that's what we're worried about, then that worry ought to be directed to those people in charge of military radar and commercial television, because those are the people sending out signals by which our existence and position could be determined.
In your recent book, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, A Search for Who We Are, which you wrote with Andrian, you look at human life and animal life and life forms in general and who we
are.
On
this planet only.
On this planet only. What about extraterrestrial life? How different or similar might we expect it to be?
Well, first off, we have to say that, of course, we are ignorant about extraterrestrial life, not having found any. So, I will try to answer your question based on the principles of biology, but I just want to stress this is at most a plausibility argument. We don't actually know anything about extraterrestrial life, even if it exists. But if we look at the evolutionary process and see its powerful stochastic or random aspect, when a mutation occurs determines which genes you have and therefore which organisms will survive and which not, and can be determining of the whole future history of that particular line of life, then even if you started the Earth out again, identical in every respect, and merely let random processes operate, I think it's very unlikely you would wind up with human beings. You might wind up with beings as smart or smarter than us, as moral, as compassionate, as anything else. But they would not be humans, because humans are the result of a particular, long, tortuous sequence of evolutionary steps that it is impossible would recur precisely in the same order if the Earth was started out again. Let me take a trivial example. Why do we have five fingers on each hand? It's because we come from some, I don't know, Devonian fish that had five flanges in its fins. And if we had come from one that had six flanges, so we would have six fingers on each hand, and we'd do base 12 arithmetic, and base 10 would be a puzzle for everybody except, you know, smart teenage kids or something. And now think of that same thing in terms of biochemical evolution, in terms of neuronal evolution, brain architecture evolution. And I think you can see that things could have turned out not completely, but extremely differently. And now if you ask about another world with different starting conditions, different physical environment, different random factors operating, a different period for evolution to occur, they must be very different from us, would be my guess. But of course I could be wrong.
My guest today is Carl Sagan. He's director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies and professor of astronomy at Cornell University. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Let's talk a little about the relation between science and technology. You speak of it very inclusively, science and technology linked. Some people talk about, oh, technology's over here and science we kind of throw over here. How do we have to think about that?
Well, let me say some things about it. Take a look at what the major networks deliver in the way of science, what the so-called science reporters talk about. It is almost entirely medicine and technology, almost never any science. Even when Nobel Prizes are awarded, it's a wonderful opportunity to at least explain what these people won their Nobel Prizes for. It's, one or two sentences, may someday help to cure cancer, and today in Sarajevo, never, almost never, do we hear say, why not? Why aren't they ready to describe what the fundamental science was about and have done background stories in the same way that newspapers do obituaries in preparation for the time that some prominent figure is going to die? Why aren't there stories prepared about all sorts of different science that can be delivered when somebody wins a Nobel Prize, or just delivered anyway? We know how to do technology. There's a new machine and it will do this or that for you. We know how to do medicine. You may have this disease someday. Aren't you glad that some progress is being made in it? But we don't know how to do science. We don't know how to say, this discovery on the nature of the genetic code, or on the deep structure of the Earth, or on quasars 10 billion light years away, people who run the media do not know what to do with that, and moreover, are convinced that the public is too stupid to understand it. The media gatekeepers have in general, there are some exceptions, have a very low estimate of the intelligence of the public. And this, of course, gets to be a self-confirming prediction. On the connection between science and technology, technology, of course, depends on science. Technology is an application of science. The science, sum of the science of today leads to the phenomenal technological developments of tomorrow. A lot of the science of today leads to no technological developments. It is merely part of the human need to understand the universe we live in. That's worth something, too. I mean, people are naturally curious. People wish to have some degree of mastery over nature. People have a need to understand the world. And you can see it very clearly in children. Children know they're going to live in the future. They know that understanding the world is important for the future. They know that science and technology is going to determine the kind of world they're going to live in the future. And so naturally, they are focused on science and technology. One of the things that worries me so much is how annoyed adults are, some adults, when children ask searching questions. why is grass green? Don't ask dumb questions. What color do you expect it to be? Purple? And instead, every one of those questions, you know, why is the moon round? And what is a dream? And how old is the earth? What's the earth's birthday? All those questions, those are legitimate, excellent, even brilliant questions that that kids spontaneously churn up. And I think it's the job of adults to encourage those questions, to reward those questions. And you don't have to know the answer to do the encouraging. Yeah. You could go to a library. You could say, maybe nobody knows the answer to that question. Maybe when you grow up, you'll be the first person to understand it. We should encourage the scientific impulses in our children.
That occur naturally.
That occur absolutely naturally and for very good survival reasons.
Carl Sagan is the director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies and a professor of astronomy at Cornell University. I spoke to him at the first international conference on circumstellar habitable zones, which was held at NASA Ames Research Center at Moffett Field, California. You're listening to TechNation. Now we present a new feature on TechNation, Barry Evans with Everyday Wonders.
Every day we celebrate, or squander, or just live, 86,400 seconds. Now, that may sound like a lot, but consider what can be packed into a single second. The digital watch on your wrist, its heart is a quartz crystal which vibrates at a frantic 32,768 times each second. Every second, 8 million blood cells in a normal, healthy human body die. And speaking of death, somewhere around the globe, on average, 2 people die and 5 are born each second. Our sun radiates 13 million times the annual U.S. energy consumption every second, while a man's testicles manufacture over 2,000 sperm, each carrying his entire genetic code. Each second, the United States racks up $7,000 interest on our national debt. That's a cool $25 million while this hour-long program is on the air. Ever wonder about your junk mail? In any average second, the U.S. Postal Service delivers 200 pieces of it, but not all to your door. And light travels about three-quarters of the distance from the Earth to the Moon. And not just light, but any waves in the electromagnetic spectrum, including microwaves, radar, infrared, ultraviolet, and X-rays, not forgetting the means by which you're hearing my voice right now, radio waves. The signal emanating from your local radio transmitter is radiating out into space, as well as into your radio receiver. The radio wave carrying whatever Moira was saying 20 minutes ago is passing Mars right now. If a sufficiently sensitive radio receiver on the surface of that planet could sort out your transmitter's signal from the vast cacophony of radio signals now being broadcast on Earth, beings on the red planet would currently be listening to 20-minute-old Tech Nation. Don't laugh. They probably listen every week.
Barry Evans is an astronomer and the author of Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for TechNation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.